sitting here in limbo. But I know it won't be long. Sitting here in limbo, like a bird without a song. Well, they're putting up resistance, but I know that my faith will lead me on. Sitting here in limbo, waiting for the dice to roll. Sitting here in limbo, got some time to search my soul. Well, they're putting up resistance, but I know that my faith will lead me on. I don't know. But I know that my faith will lead me on.
That's Jamaica's Jimmy Cliff with Sitting in Limbo. That was released as a single at first and then featured in his 1971 album, Another Cycle, and as the soundtrack for his iconic movie, The Harder They Come, released the following year. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, July the 21st, and I want to return to this question that all of Congress seems to be lying to themselves, to each other, and to the nation about, and that is this matter that variously has been described as a crisis at the border, illegal aliens crossing the border, an immigration problem, an urgent humanitarian situation, and a surge of unaccompanied children. Well, of course, much care is taken not to use the R word, R as in refugee. Now, I talked about this early on, and I said to you, and it turns out that people are now beginning to see the wisdom of it. This was never an immigration problem. These folks who are laying literally their lives on the line are not proceeding with the regular immigration process, which is a very orderly and structured process. It involves filling out forms and documents and paying fees and going for interviews and having your records checked and all of that stuff to ease in an orderly transition from one country to the next. That is immigration. But what we're seeing is a mass movement of people from points south of this border of the United States. And there is very seldom anything good that causes a mass migration of people. This is not just a mass migration. This is a forced mass migration. And a forced mass migration which now is involving more and more children, unaccompanied children. Well, why do people just wake up one morning and say this is a great day to mass migrate? No. These are acts of desperation These are acts of people who simply see no other alternative but to take extraordinary chances with their lives or the lives of their loved ones, in the hope that at the very least they would be able to live free. But as we are seeing, more and more, the attitude in Washington is that certain huddled masses are not entitled to breathe free. This was a message that came to us from a leading Hispanic, they call him a leading Hispanic, they say. He's a congressman, actually. He's Puerto Rican from the city of Chicago and is a prominent member of the Democratic Party, Luis Gutierrez. And here he is talking with MSNBC's newest acquisition, Jose Diaz-Balart, about this situation. And here is what he advises. And this is representative of the Hispanic caucus, of which he is a prominent leader.
D.C. Congressman, who gets outside of Washington and talks to people on the front lines of this debate. You're meeting with the president today. What will you tell him?
We're going to tell the president of the United States today that the Hispanic Congressional Caucus unanimously adopted a position that, look, we're for supporting you in your petition to getting additional funds. We think the children should have court hearings quickly, right? And that their petitions for asylum or other relief should be heard quickly by our court system. So we're going to support you in doing that. We want to send a very clear message to the children. Don't come to America. Most of you will not prevail in your asylum claims and will simply be deported from the United States. Don't go through this harrowing, dangerous thing for nothing. And let's figure out. And we're going to give the president some other alternatives. But well, we want to do it quickly, Jose. We don't want to circumvent the existing rules that are in place to protect the children and give them their day in court. So let's get them judges. Let's get the courtrooms. Let's get the stuff set up so the kids can get their day in court. But let's not take away legal rights that the kids have to a lawyer and to their day in court.
Well, that sounds all nice and good. Now, this is, by the way, he is also a prominent fixture in the progressive Democratic caucus. And this is the advice that he has. This is the attitude and the mentality, even among the so-called progressive element within Congress, within the Democratic Party. Well, what he's not saying, of course, is that all these rules that, you know, the rights that they're hiding behind, that these children ought to have their day in court and all that stuff. That sounds very good, except that a small bit of finagling has already occurred. And that is that this matter has been removed by the agreement of all parties, Republicans and Democrats, progressives and conservatives, liberals, they all agree, white, black, Latino, they all agree, let's get these kids out of here. And we don't need to actually submit to international conventions on refugees. We just don't need the interference of any entity outside of the United States. So what we will do is we will convert what really is an international issue of refugees to a national issue. And for that, they decided to reach back to 2008 and convert a segment or two of the, it's called the Humane Act. It's so ironic the names that these things have. This Humane Act that deals with human trafficking. So what they've decided to do, and they all are in agreement with this, we will consider these persons who have crossed the border not as refugees, but as people who have been trafficked. And therefore, we take away from any international entity, any independent body that would be supervising our conduct as a signatory to international conventions on human rights and refugees. We will now, this now becomes a national matter that we will deal with in Congress. we take that off the international table, we now contain this problem, and we will deal with it ostensibly under national law. They all are agreeing to this. And this was done in pure daylight, broad daylight. Nobody's hiding at all. This is the kind of treachery that we have in Congress, where people could do whatever they want to do. And the reason they did this, and the reason they are doing this, is because they have seen, as I have, the faces that are crossing the border. And these are the latest manifestations, for the most part, of indigenous people, whether they come from Honduras or El Salvador or Guatemala or Mexico. They are the latest manifestations of indigenous people. And in every country where you have indigenous people, practically, you find that indigenous people are the most wretched of those countries. Look at the United States. Look at what Native Americans live with every day as indigenous people, as the First Nations of this country. The highest unemployment rate, the worst health and education, the greatest poverty. You go to Australia, same thing. You go to South Africa, same thing. Anywhere you find indigenous people in a country that has been raided and settled and colonized by foreign marauders for generation after generation after generation, for some reason, the indigenous folk are the ones who are considered perfectly expendable. Even in their own countries, they don't have that level of protection, let alone here in the United States, where Hispanic means one of three things. You're either Cuban, or you're Puerto Rican, or you're Mexican. Everybody else is kind of unprotected in a kind of no man's land. And there are political considerations now that, of course, are trumping human rights concerns and international law. They're getting ready to go on their hiatus, their month-long hiatus, starting August 1st. They know they're not going to deal with this question. The president has managed to ignore it since being formally notified in 2012. So what they're doing is, let's just do a fast fix here. The most important thing is to get these people out of here. By any means necessary, let's get them out. So the human trafficking clauses of the Humane Act will provide the wherewithal for them to do that. Then they will give the president a couple of billions of dollars, I imagine. He's asking for almost $4 billion, $3.7 billion, which is another way of basically cranking up several jobs programs. Has nothing to do with immigration reform, but it does have to do with providing lucrative contracts to build walls, to provide more judges and more border patrol officers and social workers and the like. So that's a jobs program. But these Democrats are the absolute dregs. I mean, you can't even depend on them to take a principled stand and hold to it. Here is Gutierrez, very prominent guy, supposed to be a very, very progressive-minded person. But he's looking at re-election. He's looking at his rising star within the Democratic Party. But most of all, he's looking at how the Democratic Party behaves to people with people who are deemed to be disloyal. Everybody now has to fall in line behind the president and his so-called reforms, whatever those are. We don't know what they are because we haven't heard anything. We haven't heard his proposals at all. But they're so terrified of the wrath that will come down on them that they dare not step out of line, even if it is to maintain a principled stand. And so they cave in and they take the position that the administration wants them to take, which is, let's get these kids out of here. Let's get them all out of here. They are completely unprotected. And so they are expendable, and anything could be done without much alarm. When the presidents of Honduras and Guatemala and Mexico and El Salvador meet with President Obama this Friday at the White House, it would be interesting to see what comes of that meeting. What the president actually will be discussing as U.S. immigration policy, but more so what he will be discussing as U.S. refugee policy. And you notice there is not even the slightest concern that there's a cause and effect, as I said in my last piece about this. There is a cause and effect between, you know, the consequences of a problem and the problem that was caused in the first place. The United States continues to operate in a kind of vacuum and encourages us all to develop very short memories or no memories at all, so that we don't link these things together and we don't see them as being connected to the current situation, because that's the way it operates. On a very primitive level, I talked about primitive thinking, that the solution here is just to send people back, keep sending them back, and that solves the problem, as if it has nothing to do with U.S. policy in that region of the world, as if it has nothing to do with the support of these right-wing regimes and the overthrowing of democratically elected governments and the undermining and the destabilization of governments and the fomenting of internal chaos and unrest and the militarization of corporate greed, as if these things are completely disconnected from this desperation that has set in by masses of people who see no way out but to flee, literally with whatever they have on their backs and with their children. So I want to remind us that a major crime, a major wrongdoing has been committed by this administration and by members of Congress in full view of the American people. The insistence for, and I believe it's not just logistical issues, this is a racist problem. This is a problem of racism as well. For exactly the reason I pointed out, these are indigenous people, and therefore they have little value. Therefore, nobody needs to get all exercised about them. But they do serve a great purpose in revitalizing the political season and putting again on the map the unfinished business that the president and other misinformed people are calling immigration reform. It gives another reason for the Democrats to engage with the Republicans and pretend that we are having democracy. This is the farce that is going on. And they're doing this in our name and at our expense. We are actually paying these people to underperform spectacularly. We can't dislodge them, but certainly we can leave them, which is another reason, again, I come back to my theme, it is time to dump the Democratic Party. This party has absolutely no moral bearings whatsoever left. You've got to walk away from this. It is putrid. And it is insulting to our intelligence that this is what they do. And, you know, stick their chests out like that they're doing something in the name of the public. The Democratic Party has become a collection of predators, political predators. And anything that you think they would stop and think about, they just go right along with it because it's a matter of expediency. Their political survival is more important than everything else. Well, how did this problem come to be? You know, I always like the idea of stressing the need to appreciate the context of things. And in this regard, I want us to consider this short journey that Dr. James Petras, a Bartle Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Binghamton University in New York, author of more than 62 books and more than 600 articles and professional journals. He has done a lot of work, I mean years of work, decades of work, in the area of social justice, working in particular with the Brazilian landless workers movement for 11 years, and working against repression in Latin America. Here he is, and this is about 5 years ago, and this is very important to stress that. We're hearing him give an analysis of 2009 in which he is discussing what he calls the golden age of policymaking, both by the United States government and by U.S. corporations in Latin America, that produced the calamity that we are witnessing today at the border and in those countries in Central and South America. So I want us to appreciate this as a context. It's certainly not the be-all and end-all, but it is a very instructive insight into these dots that we should be connecting between the consequence of a problem that we are seeing unfold before our eyes and the origins of the problem. So here is Dr. James Petras.
Mark, 1990 is a way of indicating a dramatic change that's taken place between the United States and Latin America in the last 20 years. During the Clinton period, 1990 roughly, or even earlier, from the middle 70s to the end of the 90s, is the golden era for U.S. policy groups, corporate interests, banks, in relationship to Latin America. This is a period where over 3,000 public enterprises were sold off to private sector and mostly foreign capital within the private sector. This is the period when loans were made to Latin America that had no impact on development and were recycled back into U.S. banks. It was a period of pillage, gross, crude, primitive pillage. Interest, royalties, transfers of wealth, large-scale illegal transfers of wealth by the wealthy in Latin America to U.S. banks. The growth of U.S. banking was fueled in large part by $200 billion a year transfers, and it wasn't all narco money. So we have this period of the decapitalization of Latin America. It was during the period of the return to electoral politics. And this was the slogan at the time that Clinton, we had free markets, he said, and free elections. And that's the golden rule for the new epoch in Latin America. The 1990s, however, was a disaster for workers, peasants, public employees, and the whole paraphernalia that we associate with marginal societies. Rural immigrants to the city, the low-paid, low-income service sector, domestic servants, gardeners, car washers, etc. During this period, ignored by U.S. policymakers, there emerged a whole series of mass movements. In particular, the landless rural workers in Brazil, who expropriated and settled over 350,000 families through direct action. This was the period when the Indian communities of Bolivia, Ecuador, arose and began to challenge the dominant governments because they were being evicted and displaced from their lands by the mining company. This was the period in which this false boom in Latin America began to deteriorate. By the end of the 1990s, there was a whole series of social insurrections against elected governments in Bolivia, in Ecuador, in Argentina, and political explosions in Brazil and Venezuela. There was an attempt to overthrow the Chavez government that was defeated in 48 hours, a record in Latin America. Military coups usually last decades. So there was this golden epoch which marked the thinking of the great majority of Latin American people as the decade of indignity, the decade of plunder and pillage. And it was followed by this massive, extensive social upheaval throughout the region. In Argentina, I was there. I was working with the unemployed workers. It was like any revolutionary epoch. The middle class was impoverished. The banks froze their savings. They were literally unable to buy their meals. And they suddenly became radicalized on a massive scale, meeting in the streets and holding impromptu, what they call street parliaments. The unemployed blocked all the streets, major highways, and didn't allow any traffic to go to and from the factories. This period that lasted roughly from the 2000 to 2003 demonstrated that the neoliberal free market capitalism was dead. It was dead in the sense that it had no social basis to sustain anymore any regime that was going to pursue that policy. And yet, these great social upheavals did not lead to a social revolution, even though they had programmatically positions, revolutionary positions. Now, one could discuss all the reasons why, that they didn't have a political leadership, that a movement is not a party, that they didn't have a vocation for state power. I talked to a Bolivian miner after they overthrew a government and they were massed in La Paz in front of the government palace. I said, why don't you take state power? And they said to me, how do we rule? So you had this tremendous power to veto regimes, pro-U.S. regimes, pro-neoliberal regimes, but an incapacity to substitute a workers' and peasants' government. In that space that was open between the fall of the pro-U.S. regimes and with it, U.S. prestige, influence, and whatever, there emerged a whole series of center-left politicians who articulated an attack on the previous period and the regimes responsible for it, put distance to the United States, but also contained, co-opted, neutralized the mass movements. And they did so through a whole series of social reforms largely based on providing unemployed workers compensation, food subsidies, subsidies on food prices, and a whole series of public works projects. They were able to bring into the government in social development ministries and related positions some of the key leaders, or at least they were able to divide those radical movements. As a consequence of that, you had in place governments that had sufficient autonomy from the United States to begin to think about developing somewhat more independent policy. The second factor that intervened was the commodity boom that took off at the end of 2002, the agricultural, mining, oil prices that provided the center-left governments with sufficient resources to pay Peter and Paul. That is to subsidize the bourgeoisie, provide them with loans and financing to reactivate the economy, and also to make social concessions to the working class. The skyrocketing copper, tin, lead, soya, corn prices, iron, oil, gas, fed into the treasuries. And this further strengthened the independence of these governments, particularly as the engine of growth shifted from the United States and Europe to Asia. China became, as I'll discuss later, the main trading partner with Brazil, the biggest, most industrialized country in Latin America. After 70 years of predominant U.S. commercial investment dominance, in this past year, China has surpassed the United States, not only in Brazil, but in Chile, a more moderate political regime, and even in Peru, which is one of the last clients of the U.S. in Latin America, because that's where the market is. So we have this situation now where Latin America has carved out for the first time a degree of autonomy which is beginning to manifest itself in regional politics. Let's look at the most recent developments to get a fix on this. We have, for example, two regional meetings just recently, the last couple of months. In April 19th and 20th, there was a summit of the Americas, a meeting of the political leaders of this hemisphere, where Latin America, 32-1, voted to integrate Cuba into the hemisphere country. There's only one country alone. It couldn't even count on the banana republics. The banana republics are in revolt. Secondly, the U.S. didn't dare put forth its political agenda there. In other words, what's important is not what was voted on. It's what wasn't discussed. There was no mention of the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, because everyone knew in anticipation it would be shot down. Then came the Organization of American States, used to be called the Organization of American Colonies. Once again, it took place in Honduras, of all places, emblematic of the Banana Republic. Zelaya, the new president of Honduras, is hooking up with President Chavez is part of a Caribbean petroleum trading alliance. In other words, the U.S. no longer sets the agenda and dictates regional policy, grosso modo. I want to underline that this relative autonomy of Latin America does not signify that we're talking about revolutionary governments. There are some, or there is one, in the region. But we're talking about the vast majority of regimes that are center-left, center, and even some who are rightist regimes. But cannot even the last allies of the United States, Colombia, Mexico, and Peru, are not going to go to bat for Washington on issues where they're grossly outnumbered. Now, as I mentioned, we have to look at what is going on in Latin America among the established regimes. First of all, there are at least three new trade alliances that exclude the U.S. There's Mercosur that has existed for the last 20 years, which brings together Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Bolivia in a trading unit. There is the new and more radical regional alliance centered in Venezuela, including Bolivia, Nicaragua, Cuba, and Ecuador, which is developing joint ventures and other kinds of associations. And there is Petrocaribe, which is centered in Central America and in the Caribbean, what used to be called the U.S. patio, and based on Venezuela selling cheap petroleum, subsidized petroleum to these countries in exchange for some kind of services, in the case of Cuba, health programs, doctors, dentists, etc. George would appreciate that, that provide free medical treatment to all the poor people in Venezuela. So we have these three overlapping regional organizations that serve as a counterweight to U.S.-centered trade relations. What I'm suggesting is these are all indicators of the relative decline of U.S. hegemony and governance in the region. That is at the elite level. We're not talking now about civil society. We're not talking about mass movements. We're not talking about policy. We're talking about capitalist governments orienting policy largely toward developing capitalism, taking account their social and political history. Because at the back of the mind of these current rulers is the fact that in the background are the social upheavals of the early part of the decade that define certain parameters that you can't overstep. That if you push too far in this capitalist direction, you may get another December 20th in Buenos Aires. You may get the 2003, 2005 insurrections in Bolivia. You may get the Indians coming down from the mountains and taking over Quito, etc. That forms the background. That provides the social constraints on the kind of capitalism that's developing in the region. Now, what I think is important as we look at the electoral politics of the recent period is that every single election except one, U.S.-backed candidates were defeated. Correa won in Ecuador. Chavez won the constitutional amendment allowing for re-election. We have the elections in Uruguay, Brazil, etc., Argentina, where the center-left candidates defeated right-wing pro-U.S. candidates. We also have outside of the electoral arena an attempted coup against Evo Morales in Bolivia in September, financed by AID, National Endowment for Democracy, and a whole slew of NGOs that were operating with U.S. funding and that engaged in violent activity. And it was stopped in part by large-scale mobilizations of miners, Indians, etc., who came down and put a stopper to it. So it's not just we have, everyone says, well, the elected government's moving from the left, but there are elective governments that are backed by mass movements. Just as President Chavez came back to power with the support of constitutional militarists and 1.5 million people that came down from the slums and took over Caracas and shoved back the coup makers in 2002 and have subsequently defeated every attempt to displace President Chavez. Now, one of the areas that we're told is where the U.S. has scored some points is in Colombia, and there's no doubt that the guerrilla movements there are somewhat in retreat, but they've not been defeated. There's no decisive defeat in that field. Moreover, in Colombia, outside of the guerrilla field, there are a vast number of peasant electoral center-left groups that are in positions to occupy important positions in the government. So we have also in this regard that the ideology with which the U.S. Was able to exercise its power is totally discredited. Absolutely nobody talks about the free market in Latin America today. Even the free marketeers criticize it, at least on their way to power. The second thing I think that's important to realize is that the principal allies of the U.S. at this time are under siege. Mexico is a failed state. Half the country is run by the narco traffickers, and the other half is run by a corrupt military political elite. It's a very volatile area of dual power. Not in the progressive sense, workers versus the capitalists. It's between the narcos and the corrupt ruling political group tied to the U.S. And the root problem cannot be solved as long as the political regime maintains its alliance with the United States, because the roots of the growth of the mass organizations of traffickers is rooted in the free trade agreement. Let me explain. Free trade agreement led to the bankruptcy of over 2 million Mexican peasants. Some of them came across the border, immigrants. Others became part of these nut drug trafficking organizations. Became vast welfare organizations as well as killing machines. There is no alternative with the import of subsidized agricultural goods from the United States. You go to a place like Zacatecas, where I used to lecture. You go through village after village, and they are empty. Some of them have gone north, Chicago, Los Angeles, etc. Others have been recruited into the drug traffic. Young men, especially between 20 and 30, not there. As long as you don't have a viable legal economy where people can earn a living, they're going to look to the alternative economy. The lucrative, well-paying alternative economy in Mexico today for poor people is the drug trade, unfortunately. Now, in the cities in Mexico, there are legitimate mass movements. I just got an email from the Electrical Workers Union. Just a few years ago, under a very conservative government, they attempted to privatize the electrical industry. And once again, the mass movements came into play throughout the country. They didn't engage in givebacks. The electrical workers didn't say, well, what can you give us in exchange for privatizing? No, they're not the UAW. They said no privatization, and they organized over 350 mass meetings all around the country and said, the day you sign the privatization, the lights go out in Mexico. All the lights. Not select, all the lights. and they stopped cold a right-wing government at the moment. Now, they didn't reverse the entire political agenda, but again, it illustrates the veto power that remains among highly organized sectors, even in Mexico. So there is the U.S. principal ally south of the border, North America and Mexico. Now we have Colombia. Colombia is known as the death squad democracy. More trade unionists have been murdered in Colombia than any other country in the world. It's the most dangerous place for journalists and trade unionists. That government is sustained by Clinton first and subsequently with Bush and now with Obama. $6 billion in military aid, engaged largely in counterinsurgency. They don't kill guerrillas. The guerrillas are armed. You got to go up in the mountains, the jungles. They're prepared. They've got a lifetime of service, military combat. Who they kill are the peasants, the workers, who express sympathy not with the organization of guerrillas, but with their program of agrarian reform, national public ownership of utilities and strategic industries, demilitarizing the country, etc. Human rights. And for that, each year you get 2,000 or 3,000 trade unionists, thousands of peasants killed in order, as they say, to empty the pond to catch the fish. And so we have 3 million internal refugees crowding the streets of Colombia, which becomes a recruiting ground for the subversive organizations. That's Colombia. That's the prized ally of Obama, as it was the United States. At one time, Obama said he's going to deal with the human rights issue in Colombia. Now he's talking about promoting the free trade agreement with Colombia because he got nothing else going with nobody else in Latin America. The third ally of the United States is Peru. Peru, 4 days ago, Alan Garcia, a former social democrat, I don't know, he may be still a member of the Second International, it doesn't matter anymore, murdered 50 Amazonian Indians. I just wrote a short article on it. Because they protested over the giveaway of indigenous territories to the multinational oil companies who are in the process of contaminating their rivers, the air, the water they drink, the rivers they fish in, etc. So they protested for 50 days. They blocked highways, and Alan Garcia said, quote, "These savages," that's the word he used, "these savages," he said, "need to be taught a lesson because the only way for Peru to develop is with the big investments of the multinational corporation. And all these poor peasants and Indians can do is invest a few centavos on their plots of land, and there's no future." So with that attitude, they sent in the police to break up the highway blockages, peaceful activities, petitions, visits to Lima, etc. They didn't even get the back door to the presidential palace. So he sends in the police to assault and break up the protest, and there's a shootout. 20 police were killed, 10 Indians. Now, the reason for that is many Indians are conscripted into the Peruvian army. And after they serve their time, they go back to their village in poverty. But they take with them some of their martial skills. And apparently they applied it. Subsequently, Alan Garcia sends in helicopter gunships, machine guns, armored carriers. And we know from reports that we've gotten from Peru that at least 50 Indians have been murdered. And there is not a single peep from that garrulous president that we have in Washington, who tells us every day how much concern he has for democratic values and social justice. Not a peep from that loquacious, eloquent bluff.
And that was Dr. James Petras giving us a little tour that connects the dots so that we understand that there's a context to everything. This is not just a situation developing on its own, unhinged from anything else. There is a causal relationship, and we always have to keep that in mind. So we'll be following this so-called immigration crisis, and we will be following to see just how, in this political season, the Democrats are just basically trying to fix this thing somehow so that it achieves the predetermined goal, which is to send everybody back, to refuse to recognize this as a refugee issue, to refuse to submit to international conventions on the rights of refugees, and to use it as a very convenient ploy for the political contests at hand this midterm election year. Elections are right around the corner, the general elections, and then, of course, leading to 2016, the presidential election. I want to thank you for listening today, and I hope that this resonated with you somehow, that you saw a connection here, and what it is that we need to consider every time we broach a problem, we have to ask, what is the context of it? And that informs a lot about what we think we know about the problem. Thanks so much. You can give me a nice little note. You can send me a note at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. Keep it right here on PRN. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. And again, thank you so much for joining me here today. A pleasure and a privilege to be in your company.